Hello everyone. Quick announcement before the episode. I think it's important that people concerned with art from across the globe should also know when any part is going through crisis. There are protests in countries in Africa right now, and though they span from insecurity, heavy taxes, and gender-based violence to police brutality and genocide, we are all fighting for better governance and a chance to end poverty, impunity, corruption, and unimaginable violence in our home countries. In the show notes is the link to more information. It is not an understatement to say that Africa is bleeding. So click the link, be aware, and spread the word. Hi, my name is Hua, and you are listening to a podcast that unites literary artists from around the world. This is The Spoken World. On this episode, our guest is Anders Roslund. He is an acclaimed investigative journalist and novelist in Sweden. He has written 10 novels to date, and one of his books, which piqued my interest, 3 Seconds, was adapted into the 2019 movie, The Informer, with popular actors Joel Kinnaman from Altered Carbon Season 1, Common, and many other talented actors. To summarize what The Informer is, it delves into the world of the crime and investigative unit in the police force. Pete Hoffman, now Pete Coslow in the movie, is a reformed criminal working undercover for crooked FBI handlers to infiltrate the Polish mob's drug trade in New York. Pete Coslow, in trying to attain freedom, agrees to get his hands dirty, risking everything, until things go sideways and start to look very bad for him. And his FBI agents ghost him. Here's a sneak peek. Or more accurately, well, it's the trailer released for the movie.
Are you a princess?
Maybe.
Really? Give me a kiss! Give me a kiss! Give me a kiss! Give me a kiss! Oh, Prince Super Charming is back!
Yeah.
It's happening.
This is recording now and we'll be recording the whole time.
Coslow was a convicted felon.
He is also an informant for the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
We have a buyer.
I'm gonna take everything you got, Coslow.
You're a cop. These guys find out you're a cop, you're a dead man, you understand?
I'm gonna give you one chance,
and I'm gonna give it to you in a few seconds.
No, freeze! That's where I can see him, NYPD!
This is bad business.
Strozek tells me that the cop was pointing the gun in your face. You now owe the price of your life to Wojtek. How much is your life worth?
On this interview with Anders, we talk why he is so interested in the crimes division, why he left his job as an investigative journalist to start writing novels, and how he sought to make a difference with his work. Hello and welcome to the Spoken World podcast. It is amazing to have you on here, Anders.
Thanks. It is amazing to be here so long apart and still, you know, you're in the next room, I guess.
Sure. But just to be specific, I'm recording from West Africa, specifically Nigeria, and Anders is recording from Spain, right?
Yes. Yeah. Normally I live in Stockholm. That's my hometown. Mm-hmm. And that's where I write and, well, live. With my family. Right now, I have a second home in the very south of Spain, which I also use for a lot of writing. And this is very south to the border to Africa or to Gibraltar, Portugal. So right now I'm here and just enjoying life, enjoying writing. You know, sometimes when you're alone, you know, it's concentration, it's focus. And I'm supposed to get back to Sweden in the end of this month. And then I have this meeting with my publisher, and then we'll make a decision for when is the next book. There's always the next one, right?
Yeah, always. We always look towards the next one, the next book, the next episode, next chapter in our lives, and also, well, in the next book. We're already talking about, you know, where we live. So how about you tell us about yourself?
I'm unfortunately nowadays, I always considered myself as a young man, but I'm a middle-aged man. Living in Stockholm, which is the capital of Sweden, in the very northern of Europe. I have my family with now two grown-up boys and my wife and, you know, my cat. I love my cat. She's always with me. And she's called the author cat because she thinks she's writing the books. So, and I love this time. This is the best time, you know, when you get the grip of the story. It's good to be done. It's good to have the start. But now when you know, I own the story. The story is mine. And that's what I feel right now. I know the story. I know it's good enough because this is my 14th book. So it's such a good time when you're up on the top of the mountain and now walking down.
That actually sounds amazing. As a fellow story writer myself, even though definitely we are in terms of expertise and skills miles apart, you definitely take it home. But yeah, you were an acclaimed investigative journalist. And even through your writing, through the book we're about to discuss that has now been made into a movie, it talks about, you know, the justice system. And I'm just curious, did you always know you wanted to be an investigative journalist?
That's why I moved to Stockholm at a very young age, because if you want to work with television, which is how you meet a lot of people, you get your ideas out there in every person's living room. And since I was a kid, I have my reasons. I have tried to understand the consequences of violence. Why do you need violence? Why is a person using violence as a tool to get another person to sort of act in a certain way? What consequences is the violence doing for the perpetrator and for the victim? That has, since childhood, I have sort of walked around this dilemma, trying to find out that. And so when I was 18, you have the possibility to work with heavy criminals in Sweden. And since a lot of my friends went that way, I started to be the man outside, you know, the man outside helping out inside. And always focusing on young, violent male criminals. And then finding out that whatever I did, how much effort I put into these guys, I knew that 2 months later, when they are out of prison, they are back to the same prison, to the same cell, having committed the same stupid crime once over again. So sort of I moved from there to journalism to sort of with the same topic to work with the consequences of crime. And that's why I wanted to the biggest channel, which was the television channel. And I realized what a strong tool television and journalism can be together. And you can actually change things. You can reveal things. You can make a difference for a little while and in peace now and then. But 14 years later, still being able to sort of visit every living room out there, every Swedish person, they knew my voice. I had been the correspondent in Washington. I've been sort of trying to be the guest in every person's life. I realized it doesn't matter how much how much I produce my reportages, how far I go, how hard I try, this is just sort of blowing in the wind. Television is important for a second and for another second, and then it sort of blows away. So I thought I have to use all my knowledge with crime, with writing, with telling stories in another way to get through. So that's why I got back to my first love, which was crime novels, and sort of decided that, okay, there is a lot of crime writers out there, but to get through, I need to do this differently. So why don't I use this to write crime novels, half true, half fiction? So I started out writing crime novels with that sort of determination, half fact, half true, half true, half lie, half fact, half fiction. But also, I was as interested in the perpetrator, who is committing this crime? How does he think? And why does he, back to my roots, why does he commit this crime? Why this use of violence? So it was as important to write about his or her driving forces for committing the crime as the person being the victim, being sort of hit by the crime. That was my second rule. So I started writing through that, and then suddenly I met another guy called Börje. Börje, as we say in Swedish. Because I was producing a show of a special organization called Criminals Return into Society, meaning it was 11 guys. They were fed up with committing crimes, spending 3 years in prison, going back on the streets, back and forth. And now they are sort of, they had a new organization trying to help other people getting out of jail without failing. What I tried to do for so many years as a helper outside. So I contacted them and say, hey guys, I'm a journalist at Swedish television. Could I sort of join you for your first year and with a camera and try to sort of pick up what worked? How do you change these guys? So I made this documentary, which was called Lock 'Em Up. And it was broadcasted in Sweden and in a lot of places in the world because this really worked. And one of the five main characters was Börje, because he had spent time in jail. He had spent time as a drug addict. And when the documentary was done, we fell in love, not as persons, but not as lovers, but as persons. So when you are done with the documentary or reportage or whatever you do as a journalist, you are supposed to say bye-bye, next reportage, next person. But me and Börje, we continued to drink a lot of coffee and talk about the same stuff, the consequences of violence, because that was our main thing. And he experienced as a leader of this organization, Criminals Return into Society, which is a non-profit organization, the same thing as I did as a journalist. Whatever I do, I don't reach long enough. So that's why my ideas about how to write a crime novel, and we also connected as storytellers. So we decided, okay, why not write as a duo? But what happened was that we discovered already at the first book, writing about half fiction, half true, but also always with the story on top, of course, the thrill, really worked. And I was suddenly on stages with the Minister of Justice debating the law of crime. By the time we wrote the second one, which was about the trafficking from the Baltic states into Sweden with girls being bought from Swedish guys, finding it was okay to pay for a person, we had sort of already so many readers. What happens is that we have such a large crowd that I finish my job as an investigating journalist. This is my life. So I get this chance, and we write a third book about the death sentence, a fourth book about the homeless situation in Swedish, which is much bigger than you can realize, and the fifth book about this strange thing in Sweden that it's forbidden to use a criminal as an asset for a police officer. It's okay in America, on American movies, but it's forbidden in Sweden or in whole Europe, north of Europe. You can't do that. But still, the Swedish police officers, they did. And a lot of our friends, my friends and Berger's friends, prisoners, criminals, they were used from the Swedish police officer, and we knew that. And as soon as they were caught, if something happened to them, the police officer said, we don't know who that is. And they were sort of giving up, having sort of spent maybe a year in a heavy criminal organizations trying to reveal them, trying to help the Swedish police officer. They were abandoned. And of course, every time they were, if not killed, they were really badly treated, because you don't do that. You don't rat on your people. So the fifth book was including both the infiltrator and the police officer. And that was 3 seconds. And that book changed our writing, since that was a new success. It changed clothes. It as it was made, the movie, Hollywood movie started. The book was sort of finding new kind of readers all over. And so we kept this guy, Piet Hoffman, for the next book. Since this book is called 3 Seconds and we don't have a lot of imagination, the next book was called 3 Minutes. And then Berge and me, we got split ways. And this was before Berge died. And I decided to keep those two guys. So I wrote the third book called 3 Hours. And then I wrote the fourth book called 3 Days. And this summer I just published 3 Years. And then it's done. The story about those two are done. And I probably answered your question number 3, 4, and 5 now, right?
No, thank you so much. So while you were talking, you said something about trying to delve deep into not just the protagonist but the antagonist, you know, trying to find out why they did what they did. I remember there was a sort of argument we're having over on Twitter about what makes the best villain, and I think the person that had probably the highest sort of reactions or the particular answer that most of us agreed with was a villain that has humanity, right? Because those are the more realistic, more relatable kind of people, because then we get to understand why they are doing what they are doing. I'm a huge fan of the Marvel Universe, Marvel Cinematic Universe. So whenever I watch movies like Endgame, and, you know, basically there are movies, Black Panther and the rest, we can understand the villain and where they're coming from, right? So I would like to, based on the research you've done, based on the books that you've written, what would you say is the reason why these criminals who have been released always find their way back to prison?
Wow, that's that's a huge question. First, I want to go back to what you said just now. If you have a story and you want, you need, as you said, a villain, a criminal or so, to be likable and to be understandable. And that's not just for the story, it's because it's the truth of the human nature. Because what I found in my life and my friend's life, though since I have so many friends inside and outside prison, it depends on when you meet somebody. Almost every criminal, okay, we have a few, maybe even evil persons, I don't know, but all the others, it depends when you meet them in life, because they have been either a criminal or a victim. Almost every criminal has a story of being a victim, him or herself. So if you meet her or him in that part of life, he or she is a victim. If you meet him later, he is a criminal. And of course, later he is both. So it's needed to have a villain, because if he's just evil and not understandable, it's no use to write about it, right? It's just a tool to get a crazy story. Back to your question now, because even though we, and I can, I've been to prisons in Sweden, Denmark, America, and Finland, so that's my limited experience, but we don't, at least not here, and at least not in America, we don't have, you think, if you have a person, and you lock that person inside a cell, and you do nothing to change that person's mind, you will not have a more healthy person when it's time to go out. Why don't you use that time to force him or her to sort of go in therapy in prison, to try to understand, why did I commit that crime? Not because it's pity, because you don't want more crime victims. Because if he's let out 5 years later without any treatment, he's not well, he's not understanding why he committed the crimes in the first place, and he will commit them again. So if you don't, because I always meet these answers, oh, you feel pity for the... No, everybody has a responsibility for your own life. But if you want less crime victims, you, your daughter, yourself, then we need to treat the perpetrators. Otherwise, they will commit again. So at least the ones I know, or the followed or tried to rehabilitate, they didn't get enough tools to realize why they act as they did. I have seen changes when you reach, as Berge, for example. I mean, Berge, my former writing partner, which I wrote 7 books with in a duo, he was a criminal. He was a former criminal. He actually violated people a lot. And when he was 37, he sort of suddenly realized on, because he met those persons trying to getting to understand. So he realized, what is this life? How does my mind work? Why am I repeating myself? And suddenly he stopped repeating himself. He stopped committing crimes and creating a new crime victim. So I think he's a good example. Contributed to the society his last 25 years instead of sort of hurting people.
Yeah, but just like what you said, when we started this interview, you spoke about how you really wanted to make a difference, first in TV and then, you know, back to first in journaling and then to TV before you now started writing novels, which seem to have a more long-lasting effect. It was to sort of make a difference. And most times, in order for people to make that difference, I used to think, in the first place, why does this keep happening? One of the reasons why I thought, or why, you know, I would assume that it becomes a vicious cycle is how criminals or ex-criminals are treated the moment they step out of jail, right? There's already this mindset, there's already this stereotype, this prejudice, this discrimination that makes them feel like the only job that would accept them is the crime they used to commit before, right? In case they were into those sort of crimes where they weren't just hurting people for fun, but they were making money out of it, right? Drug dealing, stealing, and assassination of the likes. So yeah, you just like you said, it is a pretty difficult question. And I don't think you pity those people because you feel like there is a need to have some sort of reform, right? Because this is where this is what prisons are meant to be, right? Detention centers, reformation for the inmates in order to make them better upstanding citizens. So there isn't enough effort that is put into reforming them so that these things don't keep happening, right?
That is my true opinion. In a few cases, prison is just needed to actually get a person away from the streets because that person is too dangerous to have outside. But but that's actually a few of these all these guys or girls. The other ones are possible to rehabilitate, and the win with that is that we society have less victims, less hurt people. Peace, I guess. Me and Berge, we wrote a book, our sixth book, we wrote 7 together. It's called Two Soldiers, and the main characters are 2 real 9-year-olds. We followed them for 3 years, we joined them for 3 years, we worked with them for 3 years, because these are the heavy gangs, the young gangs, the very violent gangs south of Stockholm. When you work with those guys, they were 9-year-olds, because I remember we went to that was their hero. He was 18. He was going to prison. He was on this court, and they were outside waiting for him to just get a glimpse of him, their gang hero. And this guy, which is later one of the characters in our book, this 9-year-old boy, he hits me on my shoulder, and he says, when the 18-year-old hero of his life, a gang leader walking out his first prison sentence, and he hits me, the 9-year-old, on my shoulder and said, Anders, do you know, when I'm that old, I will also be a prisoner. I will also be a prisoner. And he was so proud. He has already decided. And if you And then you have to think, what in the... So you have, your mind is going to double, you know, it's back and forth to understand this. How is he thinking, and what environment is creating this mind? And then you realize, how is society ever going to sort of change his mind? When is that point? He's beyond the point, and he's 9 years old. So it's a lot. It's, your question is one of the best questions, and which have a lot of answers, but I guess not the full answer.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for answering it as best as you could. That was very insightful. So, taking it back to 3 seconds, being able to finally appreciate that you're living the dream as an author, I can't imagine the feeling that you had when you were told that your book 3 Seconds was going to be adapted into a movie that was distributed by Warner Brothers and Everyone Pictures. So I want to know how that story, you know, started. When did you know that your book was going to be adapted into a movie?
First, you always write a book because you love books, and everything else is sort of a bonus, an extra. But of course, in my heart, and in Borges' heart as well, I know that that was the case. You also, that in our, since we are men, little boy, and you sort of love the fact that it's also in a Hollywood movie. You are a boy in shorts and with a, you know, a candy in your mouth, and you sort of sometimes you carried a dream that you were not even aware of. So when this started, I knew the book was very filmy. It was very easy to adapt into a film because it has those moments. It's written in a pace that is close to how you tell a story in the movie business. But the way from that point to actually get the movie on the white screen is such a long way. So 2009, this book was published. 2010, this film company in Hollywood buys the rights, and then start this long, winding walk where the movie is on and off, and there is one director, and there is another director, and there's a third director, and there's a fourth, and then suddenly the management is changed, and the movie is off again, and there is a new management, and it's picked up again. And 2015, the film, the movie was all set. You had, it was supposed to be filmed in Philadelphia, so they had headlines in the paper called Philadelphia Inquirer. Phillywood is back, because they were very proud of this movie, and it was, a lot of stars coming in, and it was 90 people waiting for the film to start. I was there. I was on my way to the airport, and to be, you know, the proud author. And I read in the Philadelphia Inquirer that you could see the actors bicycling through town. So it was very, they had a prison with 300 extras ready to act. They had 90 persons, every photographer, every person, everyone was there. And we were waiting for the first filming day. And they called us back and said, we have a problem here. We will film this tomorrow. Okay. Second day, third day, fourth day, there were 90 people, professionals, costing a huge amount of money, and they were all waiting for the film to start. Then we got to know that because in America, it's very important in the state you sort of make the movie, you get a lot of tax reduction back. And that's a big share of every movie's, you know, budget. And then we got the, because in Philadelphia, which is in Pennsylvania state, they said Pennsylvania state was late passing the budget, their own budget. That meant that the paper when they promised the film to get the tax reduction was not valid. So day four, it had costed so many dollars, millions of dollars, they said, we have to finish this movie. So the headline in Philadelphia Inquirer was, 3 seconds is shutting down. Okay, 5 years of work, and I was in Sweden ready to go there. The manuscript was fantastic. And then, so the crew was sort of fading. The director, he went to Robin Hood, the new Robin Hood movie. The main character, he went somewhere else. And everybody sort of went to the next movie. 2 years passes by, and a very strong woman, a producer, still the same producer, she says, I want this done. And she starts all over again. And she sort of lifts it. So it's a new cast, it's a new director, it's new finance money. And they start all again. And late 2017, I'm first spending time in London, because all the interiors, every prison's shot, every shot in a restaurant or in a home or so is shot in London. Then we leave from London to New York, and we go to New York because this is supposed to be a New York thriller. So everything outside is New York. And, you know, when you go there, it's 32 degrees Celsius. It's a fantastic New York morning. I walked down there with it's a castle. It's an empty castle. It's a former military thing. Now it's supposed to be the facade of this prison. That day is the day when Piet Hoffman, the hero, he's actually breaking prison. So that day, I walked down that from the hill. And I see three fire cars. I see, you know, American police cars. I see military snipers. I see coach says FBI on the back. I see, there is Clive Owen and there is Joel Kinnaman. And it's all there. And it's hundreds of people. And they're working with this story, which I created in my small, 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 very small apartment, one room apartment, so long time ago. And in that moment, you're, of course, you're proud and you're that little boy standing there. So it's been a long, winding road. And to watch the movie then later in a full cinema, first time in London, was obviously in two ways. You're proud because it was the first time in 42 years a Swedish movie was made directly from a book to a movie in Sweden. So that's one point. But you're also proud because your book is getting a second life.
Wow. That was basically like a lot of years, because it was published in 2009 and it basically took a decade of back and forth and finally filming it before it was, you know, on the big screen. And just listening to how everything basically panned out, I think that you went, it was definitely an experience. And yeah, I love the movie anyway. So coming towards the end of this conversation, we have aspiring writers from across the globe. What advice do you want to give them? What key thing can they take away from today?
My only advice is that this is serious business. And I mean, serious business is not boring business. It's fantastic. It's the best thing you can do. But you have to be committed. You have to write and write. And you don't write a story on a piece of paper when in a restaurant when you're drunk. And that's, it's you know, the Hemingway image. It's such hard work. It's also hard work before you're published. And always think, I do this from my heart. This is serious. This is, you have to be there. And so when I got this chance, even if I was the head of a TV show and people said, are you stupid? Are you quitting your job? When I had the chance, I said, I will quit this job because I have to do this seriously. I can't write between 3 o'clock in the night and 5 o'clock in the morning. I have to do it for real. And if I don't make it, okay, I have to do something else, but I have to give this a chance. So enjoy it, have fun, but think about it as serious business.
Thank you guys so much for listening till the end. You know the drill. Rate, review, share. And due to the current happenings in the countries in Africa, please click the link in the show notes to learn more about what's happening. Be aware and spread the word. Till next time, my name is Hua from Nigeria.